Welcome, everyone, to the 46th and final episode of The Science Files with Dr. Rob this week. It's clear and chilly this morning, but get ready for a swing of almost 30 degrees. It's going to be warm and rainy tomorrow. Richard is not with us this week, but we're on the air to say a proper goodbye to Leah Batstone, the very first producer of the show, and she's smiling already. I'm also delighted to welcome back Dr. Andy L, this time in the co-host chair. But before we chat with Anne, let's talk a bit about today's schedule. Yes, we're going to debate something close to Richard's heart. Let's call it science in the city. Have you ever wondered how we go about doing urban planning? Is it an art or a science? How do we use evidence in the decision-making process? How can we use science to make cities better for everyone? Perhaps not the questions most voters worry about, but they're questions that have an enormous impact nonetheless. And let's not kid ourselves, though. A lot of issues in cities are social ones that need to be solved by social and sometimes economic means. Building an inclusive community is one such issue. But the inevitable concerns of how we deal with traffic, how we deal with water, garbage, and many other things all require careful attention and planning. In a damning condemnation of urban planning nearly 60 years ago, the urbanist Jane Jacobs called it a pseudoscience that focused on trying to correct newsworthy failures rather than focusing on rarely covered and yet powerful empirical successes. Just 4 years ago, Scientific American reignited this debate by arguing Jacobs' initial criticisms remain accurate today in many cases. Well, why should we care? Look, urbanization is growing across the globe. Even in Halifax, the city is targeted to grow by tens of thousands over the next 5 years. Can we develop theories to help us that help us answer questions related to the quality of life? Cities are complex, but they should be understandable systems. We can now follow and track things better than we ever have before, and the so-called Internet of Things promises to help get us even more data. So are we sitting at the edge of a revolution in city management? Perhaps. Our guest today, Sean Cleary, is a newly elected councillor for District 9 in Halifax. And yes, he's my councillor. As well as being an entrepreneur, he's also an assistant professor in management in the management department at Mount St. Vincent University. He has a keen interest in applying scientific approaches to decision making, and now he's on council. That means decisions for the future of Halifax. So aside from the fact he's my councillor and I get to grill him on air, I think everyone is keen to know what Sean thinks about the science behind urban planning and how science plays a role in decision-making at City Hall. But before we get to Sean, let's do a final weekly review with Anne. Anne, thank you so much for coming on short notice as well. What have you got to talk about today?
Well, first off, thank you for inviting me back. It's wonderful to be here. And the news that I was most interested in this week is that our Canadian government scientists, who are now unmuzzled, hope to be able to stay that way and to continue to talk about science to the public. Their union has put in a clause that says that these scientists and employees shall have the right to express themselves on science and their research without being designated as an official media spokesperson, which is really great news. Now, some of you might not be aware, but during the past government, this union that represents these scientists found that about 86% of federal scientists felt that they could not publicly share concerns about government policies that could harm public health,
okay,
safety,
so in perspective,
or the environment. 86%.
9 out of 10 yep. Government scientists felt they couldn't share the important research they were doing with the public.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, to be scientific, 86%.
Okay, right.
So just about 9 out of 10.
All right.
And I would say,
I can tell I've got a scientist in the co-host chair.
Of course. And I would point out, I am a biologist, and many of my friends worked and still work for as government scientists in Parks Canada and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And I can tell you that this was definitely the case. Many people felt that they could not speak publicly to their family and friends.
Well, you've got that really good story about what happened when one of your friends went to a conference, as I remember.
Oh, well, this occurred out west, and I won't mention names, but there are definitely researchers that would be sent to conferences and have science minders sent to follow them around to make sure that they were not speaking with media about their very important research that they were doing on the health of Pacific salmon.
Did that extend to having conversations with other scientists as well? Like, were there concerns?
So it was very tricky. These scientists were able to go to conferences and present, and they could speak to other scientists, they thought.
Yeah.
But what repercussions would happen with your employer and your director were unknown. So it was definitely a climate of fear.
So, I mean, unbelievable as it may be, I mean, I've had sort of some connections with this as well, not on my own research, but because of things that I'm involved in at the national level. And I've seen stories that were really success stories that couldn't go to air because the Prime Minister's office didn't want to have it look like Canada was committing to something in any way, shape, or form. So really great new research that was being done, in this case by an engineering firm and so on, couldn't be covered by a major broadcaster because they were concerned about how this might look like Canada signing on to something that it wasn't signed on to. So this is something that I'm very, very pleased to see has been repealed.
It is. It is amazing news. It means that as citizens who are, I would like to note, funding most of the research that's happening in Canada, you will get to hear this data firsthand from the people that are collecting it.
Okay, that's great. So we should be seeing a big difference in terms of the news coverage of government science over the next few months. You a Star Wars fan?
I am, although I haven't even seen the most recent movie.
That's okay. Neither
I hope to rectify that this Christmas.
Yeah, it's only just come out. In fact, a friend invited me to go and see it, but I couldn't do it this week. But so I love the fact that people are kind of playing with this a little bit in the media. And so there's been actually, there are two stories this week about what it would take to build a Death Star and the economic ramifications of doing that. Now, this is all completely silly. Everyone, just remember, we don't even know how you would actually power a Death Star, yet alone build it. But anyway, so they worked out how much steel you would need to build this thing. And I mean, you're talking about something as 87 kilometers in diameter.
Wow.
And so you would need, I think they said, it was 830,000 years worth of supply of steel from the earth. So it's not something that you're going to build in a hurry to begin with.
Wow.
Although there are ideas that if you build robots that build other robots, you can actually get an exponentially large number of them fairly quickly. So one of the things people have talked about is building something called a Dyson sphere to capture all of the solar energy around the sun. And although it's just ideas right now, if you build self-replicating robots, you can actually create lots of things, as long as you have the raw resources, of course, and build things fairly quickly. So anyway, but with the Death Star, the other problem they said was it would release so much emissions into the atmosphere that would be like global warming on steroids and a really bad thing as well. And then the economists piped in, and you know when the economists piped in, it's always, well, we can't afford to do this or that. And so they were saying that actually the rebels destroying the Death Star was actually such a bad thing to do economically that they'd suffer the economic repercussions for that as well.
So they should have just taken it over and used it for their own purposes.
Something like that, yeah. Just get rid of the Empire and take it over somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is just really funny to see this. And so you had something about ants swapping saliva, French kissing ants or something?
French kissing ants. So one of the stories that really caught my attention this week was scientists. So this is a group of scientists at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland decided they were curious. When they know that ants share food, kind of mouth to mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're doing this, what else are they doing? What else are they sharing? And so they did an analysis of ant spit and found that in this spit, there's more than just food and some enzymes. There are things like hormones and also genetic material. And they think that the ants are using these substances to communicate with each other.
I'm really pleased I don't have to tell people where something is by French kissing.
I know. Can you imagine having to communicate that way? I mean,
communicable diseases. For the whole sort of like, what do you call a group of ants? A hive? I don't know, a nest or something? I'm not sure.
Colony?
Colony.
I'm not an entomologist.
Okay.
But they think that this transfer might be how this colony stays in such great working order. Because these ants, of course, as any of you have seen an ant colony, probably in your backyard where you don't want it, they work exceptionally well together.
Yeah.
And this might be one of the ways they are able to communicate because, of course, ants can't really talk.
Okay. So the thing that I do remember growing up as a kid was we had those flat paver slabs in our back garden. And so we had a path of them that was under the washing line. My mum used to put all of the washing out and so on. And so one year my dad said, let's see what's underneath one. So he picked it up and there was a whole ant colony underneath. Mm-hmm. And you can see how they built all of their tunnels. They had an area where there were all of the eggs and so on. And it was really amazingly well designed. And I was like, whoa, that's incredible. So now people do it with glass sheets, don't they? So you can see all of the see-through and the structures and the tunnels.
Which is a great Christmas present if you have a kid.
Yeah. So Do you tweet at all?
I don't. I do not tweet.
So you wouldn't tweet when you were sick?
I probably wouldn't tweet when I was sick. No. Who knows? Maybe you get bored and maybe I'd open up a Twitter account.
But so I've seen this recently. There was a story this week on the BBC about, and well, it's the UK, so they're concerned about sort of like toilet stuff. But anyway, and so they were saying that the National Health Service is interested in knowing when people get really, really sick from norovirus, right? So if you have diarrhea and you're vomiting and so on, to actually tweet where you are, your location, and so see to help them map the outbreaks as well.
What a great idea.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Of course, you'd kind of like something better than just a tweet because you don't know whether people are telling a lie or whatever, mm-hmm. but probably not something you want to lie about anyway.
No.
But don't take your phone into the bathroom. That's not a good thing. Phones are actually... because a lot of people do take their phones into the bathroom and sit there. They're one of the dirtiest things we actually have around. So folks, clean your phone, right? It gets pretty dirty and so on. It needs to be cleaned every once in a while.
Wipe that down, please.
Yeah, okay. You're listening to The Science Files, the very last show. We're having a lot of fun already. We're just going to take a short break for some messages and then we'll be back with our main guest, Sean Cleary. Welcome back to The Science Files, the very last episode. I'm sad to say that. And so, if you want to call in today, we'd love to hear from you, 902-405-6000. And if you're outside Halifax, 1-877-801-8255. But now's the time to get to our guest. Sean, welcome to the show. How are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty darn awesome. Thanks for having me.
We're pleased to have you part of the final episode. So, you've been on the show with Rick, well... on the station with Rick Howe, but he probably didn't ask you to tell your life story. So for everyone, can you give us the Cleary backstory of how you ended up being a counselor and what interests you have in science for that matter?
I'll try and keep it very short. So,
can always cut you off.
My background is varied. So, educationally, I've graduated in programs in economics, finance, management. And so for me as a social scientist, not a natural scientist like you guys, we still use the same method. We're just obviously studying different things. And most of what I study involves people and people's behavior, which is really hard to do.
Yeah, so, because when you study them, don't they change their behaviors as well?
They do. And in fact, in management, we call that the Hawthorne effect.
Okay.
When just by the fact that you study people, they change. It goes back to the Hawthorne studies.
I think in physics, we'd call that the oh crap effect.
And so for me, I've always been involved in politics at federal, provincial levels, as volunteer and even a staff member for 5 years. But for my passion, my heart's always been in municipal issues because it's stuff that touches us every day. It's our transit. It's our fire. It's our police. It's who can build what next to you. It's our libraries. It's, you know, all of those things that, we're very personally invested in. And so... in the last few years, as many people do, you complain about things. And so people around me basically said, you either have to stop complaining or get involved. And I thought, well, there's an election coming up this year. I'll get involved. And so the issues that I want to tackle are actually some of the issues that we're going to be talking about today. And I really see Halifax on the threshold of greatness. I mean, we have a fantastic city here, but I really think there's some things we could do just with a little nudge that would push us even better.
See, I have to say that when I came to Halifax a few years ago, it felt like there was a fairly negative climate and people feeling really bad about the state of the city. But after 2008 and the collapse and so on, and a lot of people are coming back now because of the situation out west, it seems there's actually a really positive vibe in the city and sort of hope for the future too.
Yeah. I look back to... the early mid-90s when we were just recovering from a recession in the early 90s, and you could walk down Barrington Street, you could walk down Spring Garden, you could see boarded up windows, you could see there was it was almost like doldrums we were in. And since then, we have seen some amazing activity happening. We, of course, are, as you guys can appreciate, a university town. We have an enormous resource here in the universities and the students, the faculty, the researchers that we have. And I have seen in the last decade or two an enormous amount of positivity, of energy, of enthusiasm, of investment. And so I look at that and think, I've never seen Halifax as vibrant and as dynamic as it is now. But that's not to say we're in a good spot. We're sort of just coming out of a bad spot. And I think we need to move even further.
Well, it's that feeling of confidence that's so sort of like important. And the feeling that we can really change things, like a lot of people said, oh, Halifax is conservative, it won't change. But it really starts to look like things are changing.
That's not to say we're not conservative. We are conservative in sort of the small C sense. We don't like change. We don't do it well. We don't do it often. But if you look around, especially in the last couple of years, change is very palpable. It's very tangible. You can see it everywhere. You can feel it everywhere, whether it's cranes in the sky, whether it's new buildings like our central library, whether it's, you know, those fantastic institutions and community groups that have formed. Change is definitely here now. And for some people, that's scary. For other people, that's very exciting.
Yeah. So you want to jump in there?
No, I was going to say, I think that makes Halifax a really great place for science-based decision-making too, because I think Haligonians and Nova Scotians in general, maybe we are a bit slow. I'm from Dartmouth, so I can say this. Maybe we are a bit slow to change, but I think when data comes out and the facts are clear, people are willing to make positive change.
So when did you leave Halifax?
So I left in 1997 and I came back in 2016. And let me tell you, it's a different city. Night and day. And I can't tell you how exciting it's been to see what a great place it is now.
All right. Yeah. So we've done a little bit of the politics there, but when we will come back to that. But I do want to come back to the science side of things. So you're a specialist in management theory and that area. So can you tell us a little bit how science comes into that? Because, I mean, I've worked with managers and so on, but I don't tend to think about it being a scientific thing.
Unfortunately, the way it's practiced in many businesses, it's not scientific. And in fact, it's almost like a religion in a sense. It's very dogmatic. People have positions and they stick with those positions. There was a few years ago some great research on the way we compensate and reward people. And when we look at what we call extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, so things that we do because we love them and we're passionate about them, we call that intrinsic. We're satisfied by sort of internal factors. And they can be displaced, in fact, by extrinsic rewards. So if you pay people a lot, you give them bonuses. We know that, in fact, they become less motivated intrinsically. And the research is clear on this, but you go to any company and how do they reward people? It's with money, it's with bonuses, it's with stock options. It's not about building a system or a structure that rewards them for the kind of work that they do and the quality of work that they do. And so we have known for a long time there's a disconnect between what social scientists know and what business practices. And so unfortunately, there's a lot of that out there, whether it's government, whether it's business or corporate institutions, nonprofit sector. There's a lot of stuff that they do that's not scientific.
Yeah. So I think there's a really good book by Dan Pink called Drive that talks about a lot of those intrinsic versus extrinsic motivations as well.
And so it's funny, as a lawyer, which is Dan Pink's background, he had never practiced law, but his education was in law. But as a consultant, he's been studying motivation for decades. And in fact, I remember the first time I was introduced to this is thankfully to TED Talks. I saw Dan do a TED Talk and I ended up reading two of his books and started looking at the research into this, because it's not my specialty, but I started looking into the research. And my goodness, it was fantastic seeing, you know, this body of research for decades building up to this, and yet no one actually practicing it in their businesses.
So you just dropped in a really little interesting Easter egg there, and that's TED Talks.
Yes.
So you mentioned that you were involved in an upcoming TEDx.
I've been organizing TEDx conferences at the Mount for the last 2 years. So we did one in 2015, 2016, and I'm organizing another one for February 2017.
Ah, okay.
And so this will be my third and probably final TEDx at the Mount, because I will be devoting my full attention to council duties in the future.
You should be spending all of your time on council duties, nothing for anything else.
So says your constituent.
That's right. And a few other constituents I've heard from.
So I'm seeing a really big change in the way that the city, well, a lot of this comes out of Richard, I will say, is going to move forward on decision making as well. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about what's the suggestion on using evidence-based policy in the future of City Hall?
So in the last couple of weeks, City Council, with our Chief Administrative Officer and our Mayor, we've decided to sort of look at our mission and our corporate strategy going forward. So how are we going to operate? What's the framework within which we're going to operate over the next 4 years? And so we built, we refined it because it's already in place, but we have a mission, a vision, we have values, we have outcomes we want to achieve. And we were updating those. And so one of the areas where we were updating it was in how we make our decisions. So in fact, Richard and I talked about this, and Richard suggested that we should have evidence-based decision making. So everything we do,
as opposed to shouting one another in chambers.
Well, yes. So. Well, and a lot of politics, what was it? There was a comment about the Harper government years ago that it wasn't evidence. I think it might have been Scott Bryson, one of the MPs, said it's not evidence-based decision making. It's decision-based evidence-making.
So, criticism.
You're looking for evidence to support your position already, which is obviously anti-scientific.
In fact, you're showing confirmation bias. You're trying to find things to support your viewpoint.
Exactly. And so what we need to do is be open-minded and look for the data.
Yep.
And if the data points us in a particular direction, is that what we want to do? And admit that. And if not, so that's what we need to do. There's a lot of areas in the city we don't actually gather a lot of data. Transit is one that I hope we come back to.
Absolutely. Just hold that thought for a second. We've got to go away just for a couple of minutes for some messages. We'll be right back with Sean Cleary, Science in the City on the Final Science Files. Welcome back to the final episode of The Science Files. Today we're talking science in the city with Councillor Sean Cleary. We have Dr. Andy L. in the co-host chair. And if you're out there and you'd like to talk to us, ask us any questions, even bug Sean as your councillor, 902-405-6000, 1-877-801-8255 if you're outside Halifax. So you were just giving us a great answer on how science is figuring into decisions, but because science is figuring into so many decisions, Richard Zarowski has proposed having a science advisor for council. What are your views on that, Sean?
I think the idea has a lot of merit. But then it gets down to, as they say, the devil's in the details. Is it one science advisor? Because I really don't think one person can have the expertise to actually give us all the research we need. So we need a council or a series of advisors. With the city being the size it is, can we afford that? Other levels of government have something similar. Just to note, the provincial government doesn't have a science council.
So we should say the federal government is actively seeking a chief science advisor right now.
Yeah. And so, we would be certainly leaders in the municipal arena if we did something like this. But I think we could do something almost de facto like a science council just by having, and we have the resources right here in terms of the number of post-secondary institutions, people with specialization in biotechnology, ocean technology, clean technology, biology, astronomy. I mean, we've got people that know stuff, and so we should be doing a way better job of accessing the knowledge and the research experience that's around us right now. There could be all kinds of partnerships, funding. There could be many different ways we could do it. But I think Richard's point is clear that we need to move in a direction where we are bringing the best research and the best knowledge that we have on any given topic to bear on those issues before we start making decisions about them. So it's not just gut instinct, that we actually have data to say this is a good idea, this is not a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always amazed when you look at the statistics that 1 in 10 people in Halifax is a university student.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, you think about the institutions that we have here, and I mean, just 5 right around us within a kilometer or two.
Yeah.
It's got to be at least 40, 35, 40,000 students around us. We're a population of just over 400,000. I mean, that's amazing.
Are we at 400,000 now?
I think 417 was the last
estimate
I saw.
In the whole HRM. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, don't forget, is also the biggest municipal geographic area in the country.
Yes, Canadian Geographic just did a story on that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was wondering, so you've already kind of sort of gone away from this a little bit, but I was wondering who would write the science advisor job ad?
You need some extra work?
No, I don't need any more extra work. This keeps me busy enough. Radio and being a faculty member, that's enough for me. Thanks.
Well, and coming at this as someone who practices human resource management and teaches it, we would need a panel of folks to help us write this and do some sort of job analysis. But I think, that's facetious, obviously. We need to look down this road and see how – just make sure we're getting good advice.
Yeah. What's the quote? We want evidence-based decision-making.
Yeah.
When do we want it?
After peer review.
Right. So this may take a while.
Yes.
So I'm throwing this out there. I mean, you're kind of touching on this already, but how can you bring in that expertise? Because to a certain extent, we're busy scientists. We're busy sort of like working on our research. And so the city is kind of off to the side for many of us and so on. So are you looking at sort of like creating some kind of council or something like that?
I'm not sure what Richard had in mind.
Yeah.
And we haven't, I mean, this if we do go down this road, obviously it's got to come back from our staff in terms of some report how we would go through this process. I'm not sure if we're remotely close to that yet. But
so I've got to jump in. How does the process of getting advice on science issues work right now?
Well, right now we do it by consultants. And so we would hire people. You know, when we went out with a new transit plan, they had hired a consultant on some aspects of it. When we go for, I'm trying to think of some of the things that the city has done recently, where we would have planning, for example. We can hire outside planners who have expertise from other jurisdictions who can look at this from a different point of view. And so whenever we need that expert advice, we often go to consultants because we don't have them internally. So you've got to find them somewhere.
Sure.
And we have a lot of issues that we need to deal with that need scientific approach to it or data that someone else either has or knows how to collect it, whether it's new solid waste management, whether it is the health of our freshwater lakes, whether it is...
I know who you should talk to about that.
Yes, I hear you know someone.
Dr. Linda Campbell. So we actually, I think we have a call. I'm going to see if Joe's there. Joe, you on the line? Nope. Not there. Okay. Hi, Joe. Are you there?
Oh, I am. Are you?
Yeah, I am. Okay. So we had a little bit of a technical hitch, but we're there. What's your question today, Joe?
Well, I had a question for Sean Cleary, and I wanted to know if there is, as a senior, I know that I hear a lot of talk about dynamics and growth and exciting and but I'm one of those people as a senior who's watched the city grow up around them. And I've had this happen once before in my life, and I don't want to see it happen again. But it seems to be happening that, how can I put this, that the city is starting to grow up around a lot of seniors who don't have the financial capacity to keep up with what's happening. In other words, the city is outgrowing them. And I'd like to know if there's any kind of a focus or mission statement in the mission statement for council, is there anyone who or any idea of focusing on seniors issues?
Well, thank you, Joe, for that question.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
And in full disclosure, I know Joe, he's a constituent, and we've talked about a number of issues in the past few weeks.
Yes.
But he's right in the sense that when we look at the different demographic groups that we have within the municipality, whether they be seniors, whether they be those with mobility challenge, whether it be those, at the younger end, the older end, the families, singles, we need to make sure that we are a city for everybody and it's accessible. Everyone has access to it and everyone has a place in that and a role. And so one of the things we also did in looking at our corporate strategy as a city, we updated sort of our social side and we added a new value in terms of social development or new outcome, I should say, social development. And so we are looking at these things now and making sure that we have programming, making sure that we have housing, making sure that we have accessibility in our transit and our sidewalks. So as things as small as just sidewalk snow clearing. As you age, you have less mobility. I'm 45. I'm already noticing this with my knees. And
oh, you're young.
I know, eh? And so, we want to make sure that we have a city where people can get around, that they can afford to live where they want to live, and that they don't feel displaced either economically or socially from their neighborhoods.
I mean, you're touching on something that's a big deal for me. Like one of the things that I've really been concerned about is the bus system, right? And so while this may not, well, it could be still an issue for seniors as well, because a lot of them, every time I take the bus, so I take it probably about 20 times a year. I'm not on it a lot, but basically every other week I do. And it's noticeable, particularly with the younger people, they don't know when the bus is coming and so on. And that's an issue for the older people as well, because if it's cold, like if it's minus 16 outside and you don't know whether your bus is going to be there in 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour, that's not a great thing. So how are we moving forward in terms of like having apps that tell us where our bus is?
We're getting there. So by the end of this year, all our buses will be equipped with technology. So if you get onto buses now and you see sort of a big black box behind the driver's seat, that's a computer. And in fact, all of our buses by the end of this year will have those on them. So not only do they have a GPS in there so that the Transit Commission knows where the buses are, they'll also have automatic passenger counters. Because the data is the big thing. We're lacking data. So we can't build a system and we can't function without the data. And so we have a policy of open data. data. So as we collect that data, it will be open to any user who wants to do something with it. So if an app developer wants to make an app for it, and there's actually a couple of really great transit apps that you can use here in Transit 360 and Transit to get our bus schedules and whatnot, but they're just that, schedules. We don't know where they are. But as we move forward with that GPS technology, you'll be able to see where the bus is. So they're doing a pilot right now on 13 routes, and they have the oral announcements. And so for those with, say, visual impairments, can't see what street they're on, there's now announcements that are coming out that say, you know, you're on Spring Garden coming up to South Park. And so people go, oh, okay, now's my stop. I can get off. And so we're moving forward with this technology. A lot of it is going to be around counting our passengers so that we know where they get on or how many get on at a particular bus at a particular stop. But the thing is, we need to also track passengers, not in a Big Brother kind of sense, but I mean, as they get on a bus, if they transfer, we don't know that at the moment, what they transfer to. And so through either tap and go technology, through app technology, or some sort of swipe technology, which other municipalities have moved to, where you have a card that's, you know, you get on the bus and they know who you are. So if I get on the number one and I, or the number six, and I change to the 81, that we know you were on that route, you're on the next route. Because how do you build a system without knowing how people move around in that system? And that's what we need to get more of. So there will be more of that. But the question about apps, I don't want to generalize here, but older people are not going to be pulling out their iPhone.
I did try and pressy the question with that point as well.
And so when we think about older folks or anyone who doesn't have access to technology for whatever reason, maps on our bus shelters, which we don't have. Other municipalities do. And those maps, again, depending on finances, could be electronic. They could have a map that has the route and maybe connecting routes and little dots that flash about where the buses are at any given moment. Clearly, that's going to be an expensive investment, but I mean, we could pilot that in certain areas to see how that works. And especially in the downtown areas of Dartmouth and Halifax, where we get a lot of tourists, a lot of students, a lot of young professionals, a lot of older folks, because as they move in, they want to have access to, you know, the hospitals, medical professionals. And so we need to think about who we are, how we're growing, where people are moving, and what services as a municipality we can offer them. And that only comes when you have the data. And so if you don't have the technology on the buses, you're not collecting the data, which means you can't offer it to people, which means you can't do a proper analysis of your route structure. And so those things are finally coming. And that's one of the things we dealt with at council just this past month, was we have the Moving Forward Together plan, which is about updating our route structure, adding things like what they call TPMs, transit priority measures, whether those be extra lights or sensors on buses that turn red lights to green lights, or whether those be, you know, turn signs only for buses, high occupancy vehicle or bus lanes. All of those things are going to be coming in to allow us to have a better transit system, but we can only do that when we know where people are and where
this
they're going.
This is something you're obviously really passionate
about. Yes, it
is. So I just want to say one quick thing as well, that we got into a little bit of trouble with this in the past. So I do want to say that I acknowledge there are senior citizens who are very interested in technology.
Absolutely.
And use it a lot.
And they don't call Facebook mom book now for no reason, because it's an older demographic using it now.
Yeah, yeah. So you're listening to the very last episode of The Science Files. We're going to be back in just a few seconds after these messages.
Back in a moment.
Welcome back to the final episode of The Science Files. Today we're talking science in the city with Sean Cleary and co-host Dr. Andy L. And if you want to talk to us, 902-405-6000, 1-877-801-8255 if you're outside Halifax. So I just cut Sean off, as I want to do, but you know, we've got to get those ads out. So the future of cities seems to be less traffic. Do you want to talk about how Halifax is looking at moving towards having more pedestrian spaces and how bikes will figure into things as well?
Active transportation is a big part of how we want to move people around and how we will need to move people around, especially as we further add population to certain areas like the regional center. And so, you know, how we treat our sidewalks. I was listening to a program just the other day about, I think it's Holland, Michigan. They have heated sidewalks. And so they have hot water radiant piping that runs to the bottom of their sidewalks.
Okay, so the physicist in me immediately thinks that's a lot of energy.
It is. Well, they do it from the energy they're producing already. So it's basically surplus energy. They use it for heating the water and they put it under these. And it did cost them a few million bucks to put it in. But they're a small little town. They've got a great Main Street. And so they've actually just extended it to some residential areas. So I'm not saying we should do this, but we need to think about how we move people around. We're a maritime city. We get a lot of rain, a lot of snow, a lot of slush.
That was going to be my question. I mean, the bad weather climate here, whenever you start talking about creating big pedestrian spaces, everyone says, well, if it's minus 15 outside and snowing and blowing gale, I don't want to walk anywhere. I want to get in my car.
Yeah. Well, and I was watching a video just earlier today about kids in the Ukraine and Russia who, you know, like preschoolers and elementary kids who go out in their underwear and they rub snow all over each other. It's part of their ritual. and then we have the polar bear swim in January. So,
we're tough.
You
know, we're a tough people.
I think we are a tough people. And, you know, we don't often get these kind of minus 18, minus 20. We're not Vancouver, but we're relatively
not like
mild city. No. We can't create enclosed pedestrian walkways everywhere we go. We got to deal with the weather we have and make the most of it. And so, but I think how we move people around and how we design our streets for active transportation in terms of the actual infrastructure, the road design, how we can move snow clearing equipment through there to make sure we can continue having people cycle and walk on our streets and on our sidewalks is really important because we need to move them around. There was a study I skimmed through it about 6 months ago, that looked at just the impact of walking or biking to work. So everything else being equal, folks who walked or biked had an 11% reduction in cardiac disease. And so that's just one simple little thing to make our lives better.
Just from staying fit, from biking to
work
every day.
Just from walking or biking to work.
Yeah.
And that is a huge decrease in that risk. But think about the other impacts that come from it. You're happier. All the literature tells us you'd be happier when you're more physically fit. You're actually more mentally fit when you're more physically fit. You'll have better emotional stability when you're more physically fit. So all of these things add up. Plus, we'll be saving money, not directly for the city, but for other levels of government.
The economists would pipe in immediately with the healthcare costs that are saved from that.
Yeah. Well, just think about it. If we could get everyone to be 11% healthier, the impact that would have in terms of, you know, less medication for blood pressure, be less surgeries, less strokes, less. So all of those things are really important to us, and we need to build our cities so that we're healthier. We are, as you guys know, and as most listeners know, becoming increasingly sedentary as a society. And if we do not do things to get our butts out of chairs and onto our city streets, and in fact, when we get people out onto our streets, and this is another thing, speaking of data, so New York City has done an enormous amount of change to their road infrastructure, and they've tracked it all. And the previous commissioner for transportation, Jeanette Sadakon, has written a book about this called Street Fight. And in there, they detail and document all of the changes that they made in terms of adding hundreds of miles of bike lanes, many of them protected, redesigning streets, redesigning little plazas like Times Square. Mm-hmm. You can no longer drive through there on Broadway. It's closed to the public or closed to cars. It's open to the public as pedestrian space. And more people walk through Times Square every day than live in all of HRM.
Well, I've got to jump in, right? Because you're getting on something which I'm quite passionate about, and that is actually how we turn spaces into pedestrian spaces. And so you might want to talk about what you're envisioning with the center plan and how that will move forward as well.
So the center plan is right now dealing with sort of the growth centers and the corridors. So these areas on, you know, Quinpool Road, Roby Street, Oxford, you know, these areas, or sorry, Chibucto, where we're going to have a little more density. The corridors are obviously much smaller density than our main growth areas, and obviously on the Dartmouth side as well. And so looking at that, we're talking about what built form should go there. Are we talking high rises? Are we talking mid rises? If we have them, and we're dealing right now with density bonusing, so we're going to have a height restriction, but if you want to go above that up to a certain amount, what's the public benefit? Because right now, for the last number of years, the city has been just sort of giving away these benefits to the developers. Mm-hmm. And so we need to recoup that in maybe more public spaces for piazzas, for cafes, for public art, for green spaces, little pocket parks. And so if we can find these kind of things, because we know that those are the things that really enhance the quality of life of the people living in those communities. And it really pushes the built form into the background, because at eye level, when you walk around, It's the space within the first few stories that you notice. And so if what you see is great places to sit with your kids, with your dog, with your coffee, with your colleagues, with your neighbors, that's going to have a much bigger impact than whether a building is 10 stories or 20 stories. And so we need to control those heights. But what's more important is we need to control the spaces within the public sphere mm-hmm. for those of us who use them.
I can speak to what happened in my hometown where they actually took the high street and they shut that off to traffic and then paved it over. And it became like a meeting space for the whole town. It was really kind of amazing to watch it. And so when you were a kid and you wanted to go and meet other kids, that was one of the places you would go. And it just became famous as this thing. And so now every Saturday when people are there shopping, hanging out, going to cafes and so on, it really is vibrant. So where could we do that in downtown Halifax, though?
Well, Argyle Street is a great example where they're looking at, if not shutting it down completely, restricting access to one lane that's going to be traffic calmed. And in fact, the roadbed and the sidewalks will be roughly at the same level. And so it'll just feel like one big area. And I would like to see it completely closed off. But when you look at Spark Street, for example, in Ottawa, Ontario. They have that closed off for most of the daytime. They do open it in the evenings and at night for deliveries for the businesses that are along there. But for most of the time, it's closed. And so what ends up happening is, especially in the summertime, but even in the wintertime, there are restaurants and cafes that use that space for seating. It's open for anyone, and as a shopping district, it is incredibly packed almost all the time. People are walking it, people are eating, people are sitting. And so we need to find those kind of spaces where it attracts people, because if we want more business for our downtowns and our main streets, we have to get them so that people feel comfortable walking and biking on there. A great example of how we do things really poorly. Quinpool Road has the Quinfest every year, but we're not allowed to close it down to traffic. They've asked, the Business Improvement District Association has asked for it to happen. They won't give us the permit. And so what ends up happening is you're restricted to the sidewalk. The people are, the cars are still moving up and down, but the sidewalks this year were so jam-packed with people. So many people came out. I ended up having to walk on the road to get around some of the crowds because there was just that many people who wanted to experience that. If we could close some streets down temporarily for these kind of things like we do for the Blue Nose Marathon and others, but these would be, you know, just as important or even more important ways of getting people out. And there could be opportunities for streets, especially in the downtown, where we close them permanently. And only have access maybe for deliveries and whatnot in off hours. And so if we could have those kind of spaces, not only would people be happier, but our businesses would actually be more successful. In New York City, again, the bike lanes, every road they put a bike lane on, they measured, and they do this because they share data with the state level of government, and they have retail sales figures. And so there are some places, Times Square, when they closed it down to traffic, it had 167% increase in retail sales. Rents now are so expensive in Times Square because the businesses, they know as soon as they go in there, it's like buying a little printing money printing machine. They can just make money because everyone goes there and shops. And so on the streets where they put in active transportation corridors, all of those businesses actually had an increase in business.
Thank you so much, Sean. One of the things that I've really learned today is that Halifax is not going to be short of ideas. I really appreciate you bringing your knowledge to the show, and thank you so much for filling in on short notice.
Thank you for inviting me.
You saved me. Thank you very much. You saved the show, in fact, although we haven't saved the show. Leah, thank you so much for being part of the Science Files over the last year. We really, really appreciate all of your input.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
And thank you to you listeners. We've had a great time this year, I want to say. I've really enjoyed Science Files being part of my life. I don't know what's going to happen from here on in, but I want to hope that you've had a good time listening to the show, and I hope that we can bring you some more fun science programming at some point in the future. As Murrow used to say, goodbye and good luck.